This is Pat Schlarbaum, and you're listening to Heart of Iowa, a program featuring artists and thinkers of note in Central Iowa and the issues they care about. Welcome. Today we're featuring The Extinction of the Passenger Pigeon, Lessons from the Past for a Sustainable Future by Dr. Stanley Temple, who is Senior Fellow at the Aldo Leopold Foundation.
So please help me welcome Dr. Temple to the podium.
Good. Well, thank you very much. And for this crowd, I guess I don't have to remind you that this is the 100th anniversary of the passenger pigeon's extinction. It is sort of the iconic extinction event of North America, and indeed one of the most shocking extinction events in the world. However, the title that I've chosen here is really quite appropriate because most people don't know the passenger pigeon story the way most of you probably do. It's 100 years, and people have forgotten about the passenger pigeon. They're not even sure what the passenger pigeon was, let alone the story of its extinction. And during this centennial year, I and several colleagues have been trying to take advantage of a very teachable moment about extinction by giving talks about the passenger pigeon and what its extinction can teach us about our relationship with wildlife today. But I have been absolutely appalled by how many audiences have this problem. People are sort of, passenger pigeons aren't extinct. They're all over my barn, or, you know, my uncle has a loft full of them. So remembering, reminding people is really quite important this year because the story has been forgotten. But the real passenger pigeon was a remarkable species. It wasn't necessarily remarkable for its physical appearance. It was about 1.5 times the size of a mourning dove, which it somewhat resembles. But what was remarkable about the species was its abundance. It was arguably one of the most, if not the most abundant bird in the world. And it was certainly the most abundant bird in North America. It was estimated that at the beginning of the 19th century, 1 in every 4 birds in North America was a passenger pigeon. And to put the numbers that were estimated to be somewhere between 3 and 5 billion birds, to put that into perspective, if you just took 3 billion passenger pigeons and put them beak to tail, they would circle the earth at the equator 23 times. It was an exuberance of abundance that, you know, the world has rarely seen, and that we certainly don't experience anything like it in North America today. The species was notable not only for its abundance, but because it had some really interesting ecological characteristics that were very closely tied to the eastern deciduous forests. The passenger pigeon was unique in an evolutionary context. Its closest relative is actually the band-tailed pigeon of the Southwest, and it doesn't physically look that much like a band-tailed pigeon, but genetically they're quite closely related. And I'm making a point of saying this early on in the lecture because I'm going to return to the band-tailed pigeon a little later. It has perhaps an interesting link to the passenger pigeon. But what we know about the passenger pigeon, since it went extinct so long ago, is not the result of careful biological studies. Instead, what we know about passenger pigeons is largely the firsthand accounts, especially of naturalists and explorers in the 19th century. And they left a treasure trove, really, of personal observations of their encounters with this bird. And when you read these accounts, there is so much similarity between the things that they were saying that you realize, you know, that they weren't exaggerating when they described some of the episodes of encountering passenger pigeon. I'm going to share just a few of them here. Alexander Wilson was arguably the first American ornithologist, and in 1810 in Kentucky, he describes a passenger pigeon nesting area that was dangerous to walk through, because limbs and trees were toppling from the weight of hundreds of pigeons nesting in them. These nesting assemblages almost always inspired people to write about them. They were such an incredible sight to behold. Probably the most famous account comes from John James Audubon. In 1831, he was on a riverboat traveling down the Ohio River when he crossed paths with a migrating flock of passenger pigeons that flew over him and darkened the sky for days. The birds were from horizon to horizon. It was an awesome sight, and he wrote about it extensively in his journal. This is one of the quotes. For some reason, people picked up on the sky being darkened for days on end. They sort of overlooked the dung part. But you can imagine, with 3 billion passenger pigeons flying over you for 3 days in a row, nonstop, there was a lot of poop that fell. But these accounts include certainly Midwestern observers. John Muir, at his boyhood home in central Wisconsin, talks about passenger pigeons visiting his farm in the mid-19th century. And although he waxes eloquent about them, what was really memorable, as it was for many people in this period, was that it meant good-tasting fresh meat on the table. When these flocks came through the Midwest, the farmers that had had a long winter basically filled up on passenger pigeons. Well, there are literally thousands and thousands of these firsthand accounts, and a Wisconsinite, Bill Shorger, spent 15 years of his life combing through newspapers and old journals, everywhere that he could find anything written about passenger pigeons. He amassed over 9,000 firsthand accounts of the birds. And from this, he was able to distill what today is still the definitive account of the biology of the passenger pigeon. And we'll give Bill Shorger sort of the last word here. Viewed from all angles, the passenger pigeon was the most impressive species of bird that man has ever known. I think that probably is well deserved. It was certainly a spectacular species. So this great abundance of birds, billions of birds, occupied essentially the eastern half of North America. The birds were notable not because they sort of uniformly occupied this large range, but because they were nomadic. Their name, their scientific name, even means the wandering migrant. And their life history was that they were moving more or less continuously, except when they settled to breed. So, and they were nomadic in that there was no way of really predicting from year to year where they were going to turn up in the eastern forest. They wandered around looking for a rich abundance of food. And when they found that food, they would settle in and roost or nest before moving on. The birds nested in a fairly narrow band shown in red here, basically right through the Great Lakes states. Michigan and Wisconsin, Illinois and Indiana and Ohio were principal nesting areas. They did get into Iowa a little bit. There were nestings certainly in Iowa, but mostly after the breeding season, they wandered outside of the eastern deciduous forest. So they ranged out into the prairies, into the Canadian provinces in search of other foods during the summer. But the remarkable thing, of course, about this habit of wandering so extensively is that even though the birds never stayed in one spot for very long, no matter where you were in the eastern U.S., sooner or later, these huge flocks of passenger pigeons were going to pass overhead. And when they did, it basically got your attention, and people recorded what they saw. And it's not surprising, then, that eastern deciduous forest sort of lore is filled with passenger pigeon stories, because people encountered them, people ate them, people were impressed by their numbers. And perhaps not surprisingly, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of localities around the eastern U.S. that are named after the pigeon. Most people today, I'm convinced, don't know that the name of their town or the river or the creek or the mountain or the ford or whatever was named after the passenger pigeon, but all of these trace their roots back to the early 19th century, and they were named for some spectacular appearance of passenger pigeons in that area. So this was a bird that was very closely tied to the eastern deciduous forest. It was just part and parcel of experiencing that ecosystem. And They were tied to the eastern deciduous forest because they fed primarily on the nuts and seeds of forest trees. So this painting very correctly depicts them in an oak tree, and acorns and beech nuts were their mainstay. This is what they fed on. Principally, this was the fuel that kept them going. Certainly, wherever they settled to nest, it was always when beech or acorn or oaks were producing an abundance of nuts. That mast, those hard nuts of forest trees, especially beech and acorn, of course, are somewhat unpredictable. Oaks and beech don't produce nuts every year. And there can be sometimes some long intervals between when they produce an abundance. But when they do, it is really an abundance. And passenger pigeons took advantage of these two species and that characteristic of somewhere in the eastern deciduous forest, there were going to be patches of oak and beech forests that were going to have this incredible abundance of things that passenger pigeons loved to eat. So they were very tied to this, and their nomadic habits were essentially wandering around, trying to find where was the spot this year where they could find that superabundance of mast. When they found it, they settled in to nest. And the nesting was the only time during the year when passenger pigeons really stood still. They were tied essentially to their nest for about a month. Their nests were sort of typical pigeon nests. They weren't anything to brag about. They were created very quickly, very rough nests. They laid only one egg, occasionally apparently two eggs. But the remarkable thing about them during the nesting season was that they nested in these huge colonies. There would literally be hundreds and hundreds of millions of birds that would pack into an area where there was an abundance of food. Sort of the way Alexander Wilson described the forest, essentially being stripped of leaves and limbs by the weight and the sort of impact of these birds. In fact, it was described as a biological storm, so that the forests that pigeons settled in for roosting or nesting were pretty much stripped, and I might add, well fertilized. But the birds reproduced rather slowly in that they only raised one young. And like most pigeons, they reproduce, their nesting season is rather abrupt. They fatten up the squab very quickly in just a matter of a couple of weeks and then abandon this sort of obese squab, which burns off the rest of its baby fat, you might say, until it can fly, and then it's on its own and joins the flock. So, but that was the one time of year that passenger pigeons settled down. And it was the one time of year that they made themselves extremely vulnerable. Passenger pigeons' strategy of nesting in these huge colonies was actually an adaptation to predation. It's called predator swamping. When you can move into an area quickly in large numbers, you sort of overwhelm the local predator community. For passenger pigeons, when hundreds of millions of them settled into an area, there were only so many of them that the local hawks and owls and other predators were able to kill. And it greatly reduced the risk to each individual passenger pigeon by being part of this large assemblage, much like schools of fish or herds of ungulates, the same sort of strategy. Well, it worked with natural predators. It was a brilliant strategy that served the passenger pigeon well. It proved to be their Achilles tendon when they met up with a super predator in the form of human beings. The nesting season was the time when they were particularly vulnerable to people, hunting them, killing them, using them essentially as a resource. And things really started to unravel for the passenger pigeon in the second half of the 19th century. This was the time of market hunting. This was before the modern conservation period. There were essentially no laws or regulations protecting species from exploitation. And with our growing population, there was quite a demand for wild game. And passenger pigeons were one of the principal targets for the market hunters, the commercial hunters of the period. These commercial hunters literally made a living off of passenger pigeons. They followed the passenger pigeons year-round. When they settled in to nest was basically the bonanza for them. They could slaughter pigeons day and night for almost a solid month. And in doing so, they could literally kill double-digit percentages of the world population of passenger pigeons each year. And to make matters worse, the disruption of all of these market hunters prevented the birds from nesting successfully. So the fact that the birds were sort of relentlessly hunted year-round, that the market hunters followed them around, and that they were so disrupting the nesting cycle, you don't have to be a population biologist to realize if you're slaughtering the adults and you're preventing them from reproducing, extinction is a mathematical certainty. And indeed it was. In the span of just a few decades, we managed to reduce the most abundant bird in the world to extinction by virtue of this excessive overkill. Market hunting was a huge business at that time. If you go back to the U.S. Census figures, there were literally tens of thousands of people who described their profession as pigeoner. And a pigeoner was basically somebody who followed the pigeons wherever they went, killing them, capturing them, selling them to the local market. This sort of scene from a Chicago market, if you are a good naturalist, you can identify quite a few species that were pushed nearly to the brink of extinction by market hunting. There's a whooping crane, I think, or perhaps a trumpeter swan hanging in the middle there. But essentially, these market hunters were after anything that would provide easy meat that they could sell for a handsome price at the growing urban areas, especially here in the Midwest. Population was growing, they were after cheap food, and the market hunters were able to provide it in abundance. Whether it was passenger pigeons or prairie chickens or whatever, it was available for sale. And there were really, it was a challenge. Pigeons were a challenge for the market hunters, of course, because they moved so extensively. And it wasn't that easy for the pigeoners to actually track the birds and follow them because of this sort of erratic nomadic behavior. But two technological advances during the mid-19th century tipped the balance in favor of the pigeoners. The first was the telegraph system. The tremendous rapid expansion of the telegraph system meant that the pigeoners could essentially track the passenger pigeons almost in real time. Telegraph system went out, here's where the pigeons are, and all these thousands of pigeoners were on the spot to take advantage of the birds. The second was the tremendous expansion of the rail system. That not only gave the pigeoners transportation to get to the birds, but you'll notice that the great expansion of the railroad coincided almost perfectly with the nesting range of the passenger pigeon. It provided a way for the pigeoners to slaughter the birds on the nesting colonies and put them on trains, iced, and get them to the market quickly, which further encouraged this sort of massive exploitation of birds. Obviously, this is a cartoon, but this is pretty much what happened. The birds were plucked and gutted. They were packed in barrels, 300 to a barrel, with ice, and immediately shipped off, literally by the thousands of barrels, to the larger urban areas. And some of the accounts of the numbers of passenger pigeons that basically rode the rails to markets were absolutely stunning. There literally would be thousands of barrels at 300 birds to a barrel that would be leaving the nesting area essentially every day heading for the markets. And there was one particularly tragic account. At least it struck me as particularly tragic, that one of these trains that was coming from a large nesting area in Wisconsin had some mechanical problems, and the ice started melting. And they dumped 2,000 barrels, 300 pigeons to a barrel, in the Wisconsin River to get rid of them. 600,000 birds went into the river. So it was not a good time for the passenger pigeon. And as I said, during this period, if you try to reconstruct their decline, they were basically declining at about 20% a year. The biggest nesting ever recorded was in 1871. And Bill Schorger, being a Wisconsinite, he did a particularly good job of documenting this nesting. The nesting area covered about 850 square miles in central Wisconsin, and it was described as pretty much what Alexander Wilson described, you know, that there were literally dozens of pigeon nests in virtually every tree. And this was sort of the peak of accessibility because the rail system went into this area, and all of these thousands and thousands of pigeoners, as well as local Wisconsinites who were looking for a quick meal, sort of descended on the colony and literally killed the birds day and night. It was really the largest nesting ever recorded. And the details that Bill Schorger was able to unearth about the nesting sort of describe in horrific detail the excesses of the exploitation. Talks about thousands being caught in one flip of the nest, with thousands of barrels being shipped to Milwaukee and Minneapolis and Chicago. Hundreds of thousands of hunters. And the one that really caught my eye was this one dealer in Sparta, Wisconsin. Sparta, Wisconsin is just a tiny little town then. This one dealer sold 500,000 rounds of ammunition, and you can be sure every one of those was shot at a passenger pigeon. So it was pretty horrific. And that was not, you know, the only period in which the pigeons were exploited. The pigeoners followed them, and while they were moving, of course, they couldn't extract quite the toll that they did while they were nesting, but they would still continue to shoot the birds and sell them quickly to the local markets. But while the pigeons were moving, they did more than kill them. They also caught them alive. And it turns out a live pigeon was actually worth more than a dead pigeon. And the reason for that was that back in the 19th century, if you wanted to sharpen your aim with a shotgun, you didn't shoot at clay pigeons, you shot at passenger pigeons. So they would catch these pigeons literally by the hundreds or thousands in these large nets and sell them to local gun clubs to use as targets. And surprisingly, while all of this slaughter of birds, the capture of birds were going on, we have virtually no photographs of any of this activity happening. The photograph in the upper right there, though, is one interesting photograph. It's of two pigeoners. These guys are trappers who were using nets to trap the birds alive. And if you look in the circle there, perched on the handle of a little wicker basket are two passenger pigeons. Those were the lure birds that they used to bring the wild birds into their nets. And these were known as stool pigeons, because they sat them on a little stool in the middle of the net. And, of course, clay pigeons, stool pigeons are all part of our lexicon today, and they trace their origins back, essentially, to the market hunters. And, as I said, it was just unrelenting year-round. The pigeoners followed the birds and captured them or killed them. So it was pretty clear that this couldn't go on forever. The mindset of Americans at the time, though, was that the natural resources of the country were inexhaustible. It was the sort of frontier period. It was an open access period. When people got accustomed to seeing these huge flocks of passenger pigeons passing through occasionally, no one could have imagined that we could possibly extinguish that kind of resource. But we were doing it in very, very short order. The last big nesting occurred in Michigan in 1878, and after that, the nestings were far less spectacular, much smaller, but the hunting continued. It was still a period in which there was no conservation ethic in the country. There was no real attempt to effectively regulate what was happening. After the turn of the last century, when it was clear that the birds had disappeared, several attractive rewards were offered for any evidence of pigeons still in the wild, and every one of those rewards went unclaimed. So that over a very short period of time, the birds were pushed to extinction in the wild. Bill Schorger in amassing all of those records has given me the opportunity to share with you some firsthand accounts of pigeons in eastern Iowa, where they did nest and where they often migrated on their way to nesting areas, probably in Wisconsin. So here are a few records, just a few, that I pulled out of Shorger that illustrate people's descriptions of the pigeon. And if you follow the descriptions, you'll see that they go from these exuberant descriptions of the abundance of the birds gradually down to none left. So in 1838, pigeons were migrating through in large flocks, huge roost, nesting covering many square miles, flight of 100 leagues, which is 300 miles. Vast flocks were a scourge to farmers' fields. You can imagine if you were a wheat farmer in that period and you saw 100 million passenger pigeons settle on your field, it was not a welcome sight. Flocks were estimated at 120,000 an hour for 5 hours. Now we're starting to do the countdown. Then all of a sudden, they weren't seen again. 1882, pigeons are all gone. The last pigeons were seen in Iowa during the late 1880s and early 1890s. So we took these birds throughout their range, literally from billions down to none in the wild. The last known confirmed wild bird was shot in Indiana in 1902. And the very last bird, Martha, died in captivity at the Cincinnati Zoo. Martha, it turns out, was a badger. She was born in Wisconsin. The records aren't exactly clear whether she was born in captivity to an aviculturist who was sort of dabbling with breeding the birds or whether he took her as a squab. But we know Martha pretty much through her life. This is Martha on the on your right there in her juvenile plumage. Martha was the last passenger pigeon, one of the few cases where we know to the hour when the species went extinct. It was between noon and 1 o'clock on September 1st, 1914. Martha died. She was immediately packed in a huge block of ice and shipped off to the Smithsonian Institution where she lies in state. So the pigeons were gone, and people were aware of it. People at that time, of course, had seen the abundance of the pigeons, and everyone was aware that the passenger pigeon had disappeared. So it did trigger a response. Unfortunately, the response was too little, too late. By the time we actually got our act together to do something, the pigeon was actually gone. So the reaction, and to some extent I think you can attribute the modern 20th century wildlife conservation movement to the shock of the passenger pigeon's extinction, but the reaction was protection, that we would protect things from direct harm by people. And one of the first things that was done in a legal sense was the passage of the Lacey Act. And most people today recognize the Lacey Act as a piece of federal legislation that controls interstate commerce. But when John Lacey, when he introduced this bill, he described it as a way to break the back of the market hunter, to make it illegal for them to transport game from wherever they were killing it to markets by prohibiting the interstate commerce. Obviously, as Representative Lacey said, too little for the wild pigeon. It came in time, of course, for the bison and egrets and other birds that were being exploited at the time. But essentially, it was too little, too late, and we were left with nothing except sort of remembering the lost bird. And at least in Wisconsin, where we had lots of important connections with the pigeon, the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology did something to sort of remember the bird. They erected the first monument ever erected to an extinct species. The Passenger Pigeon Monument in at Wyalusing State Park was erected in 1947. And it was in memory both of the last passenger pigeon that was shot in Wisconsin in 1899, as well as the extinction of the species just a few years later. Wisconsin did have lots of connections, though, with the pigeon. We were a principal nesting area, and not by chance, passenger pigeons feature pretty prominently in Wisconsin lore. The Wisconsin Society for Ornithology adopted the passenger pigeon as its logo and the name of its journal. And in 1947, on the occasion of the dedication of the monument at Wyalusing Park, they published a little booklet called Silent Wings. And that was notable for two things. Bill Schurger published his observations of the, or his accounts of the 1871 nesting and the slaughter, and Aldo Leopold published one of his more evocative essays on a monument to the pigeon. And I'm not quite sure why the reprint, which is on the right, we reprinted it this year on the occasion of the centennial, and for some reason it's not showing up there. But Silent Wings was a notable publication and to some extent was made famous by Aldo Leopold, subsequently including his essay on a monument to the pigeon in a Sand County Almanac. And it certainly stands as one of the most poignant essays ever written about extinction. And he very correctly captured the importance of what was done that day at Wyalusing. For one species to mourn the death of another is a new thing under the sun. In fact, the passenger pigeon monument is in the Ripley's Believe It or Not as the first monument ever erected to an extinct species. And for those of you who don't know Aldo Leopold's essay, it is one of his masterpieces, and he really captured the essence of why we think 2014 is so important as an event to remind people about the passenger pigeon. He closes the opening here of the essay, but in a few decades hence, only the oldest oaks will remember, and at long last, only the hills will know. And indeed, in my travels around the country, I'm verifying that people have largely forgotten about the passenger pigeon. Well, lots of other places have erected pigeon monuments after the one was erected in Wisconsin, so there are lots of reminders about the passenger pigeon if you care to seek them out. As Aldo Leopold said in his essay, there will always be pigeons in books and in museums, but these are effigies and images, dead to all hardships and to all delights. They live forever by not living at all. So there are the pigeons in Bill Schurger's book and museum specimens. And everyone usually asks the question, why didn't we do more? It should have been obvious to people what was happening to the passenger pigeon. You could see the numbers declining. You could see what was going on. And indeed, nothing really substantial was done. A lot of people ask about captive breeding. And indeed, passenger pigeons apparently weren't all that hard to breed in captivity. But captive breeding as a conservation strategy was unknown at that time. There were a few aviculturists who succeeded in breeding the birds, including the one in Milwaukee who was Martha's original owner. He figured out how to get them to breed and was fairly successful, but it was a hobby. And their main objective in keeping passenger pigeons in captivity, somewhat perversely, was an attempt to try to hybridize them with common pigeons. So these are photographs from the aviary in Milwaukee. And we're not completely sure, but the little squab in the middle there, is pretty good probability that that was Martha. And Martha, as a juvenile, is in the lower right-hand side there. But this aviculturist got sort of tired of his passenger pigeons. He passed them on to an aviculturist in Chicago who apparently didn't take very good care of them. The flock dwindled, and eventually he got tired of them and gave the handful of birds that survived to the Cincinnati Zoo, where Martha and a handful of other pigeons lived out their lives. So nothing substantial was done to save the passenger pigeon, but many of you have undoubtedly seen the recent sort of publicity that's been focused on the phenomenon that has become known as de-extinction, bringing back an extinct species from preserved material. And because of the passenger pigeon's iconic status, the passenger pigeon, along with woolly mammoths, seem to have become the preoccupation of these biotechnologists who think that they are on the cusp of being able to take the general theme of the movie and book Jurassic Park and make it a reality. And the passenger pigeon has certainly featured prominently in their discussions, including, if any of you read last Sunday's New York Times Magazine, it was the cover story. So how would this, if it was to happen, how in the world could we ever bring a passenger pigeon back? Well, it is a complicated biotechnological feat that is a very low probability of success. But the idea is basically that from those museum specimens, we could recover fragments of passenger pigeon DNA. One geneticist described what we would have to being similar to taking the New York City phone book and turning it into confetti, and then just for good measure doing the same thing with the Boston phone book and mixing them up and then saying, here, make some sense out of it. But we have the technology to do this now. And it's possible to reconstruct the passenger pigeon's genome from all of these degraded fragments of DNA that would be contained in these museum specimens. It would not be perfect. We certainly have no realistic hope that we would be able to construct the entire genome of the passenger pigeon, but you could get quite a bit of it probably done. Here's where the bandtail pigeon enters the picture again. The bandtail pigeon is the closest living relative. And since they are closely related, their DNA is probably 99.99% similar. So the idea is to compare the reconstructed, incomplete genome of the passenger pigeon to the complete genome of the bandtail pigeon and find the corresponding segments that made passenger pigeons uniquely different than bandtail pigeons. And using genetic engineering, you would simply replace those segments of bandtail pigeon DNA with the segments of passenger pigeon DNA. It wouldn't be perfect. You would not be producing 100% passenger pigeon. You'd be producing something that had a lot of passenger pigeon DNA in it, but it would not be a perfect passenger pigeon. And if you were lucky, and each of these steps, by the way, has very low odds of success, but the next step would be to turn that into a stem cell. Probably all know what stem cells are. They can be turned into a variety of different tissues. And if you were lucky, you would turn the stem cell into an egg and a sperm. And if you were lucky, you would get the egg fertilized, and you would be able to produce a cute little squab that would be a genetically modified organism. It would not be a passenger pigeon. It would basically be a GMO. But this has inspired all kinds of, I think, false hope that we can bring some of these long extinct species back. We will probably do it in the not too distant future with some very recently extinct species for which we've preserved cryopreserved gametes or preserved DNA, but we're not going to do it with things like passenger pigeons that have been gone for a long time. So the passenger pigeon really is gone forever, and all we really have is, of course, what we can learn from the passenger pigeon's extinction. And unfortunately, our track record suggests that we didn't learn very much. It caused quite a reaction at the time, and certainly it launched the modern conservation movement, but we are still sort of ruthlessly over-exploiting wild species. I love this cartoon. It pretty accurately and vividly describes our relationship with a lot of very valuable wildlife species that we have used as resources. And because we have this really bad track record of over-exploiting valuable species, we actually have some information that we've learned from our mistakes. We know that there are some species that have biological traits that make them especially vulnerable to overkill. Species that are rare, that have a low rate of growth so that they can't replace the losses very quickly, and especially if they occur in aggregated dispersions where they all get together in one place at a time and make themselves vulnerable, those are species that are really at risk if they are commercially valuable. And on the sort of human side, the social side, economic side, if they have a high commercial value, if that commerce crosses boundaries so that multiple jurisdictions are involved in trying to regulate the trade, and even if it's not commercially valuable, we sometimes engage in overkill because we just don't like species. We treat them as pests, and we persecute them because we have prejudices against them. So pushing species to extinction by overkill, by essentially killing them faster than they can reproduce, we have a really bad track record. And certainly, you know, the passenger pigeon was not the only species to be pushed to extinction by overkill. Great auks, the large seabirds of the North Atlantic, had the vulnerability of having a low reproductive rate and getting together in just a handful of nesting colonies on islands in the North Atlantic. And we took care of them in 1844. The Labrador duck seemed to be in pretty good shape because it nested in the wilderness areas of Labrador. Unfortunately, the entire population spent the winter on Long Island Sound, and we managed to wipe them out, again, by market hunting in 1878. The Carolina parakeet, among its other problems, it was killed as a crop pest, and we got rid of them sometime in the 1920s or 1930s. And perhaps most recently, the Eskimo curlew, which was hunted at bottlenecks on its migration southward. Probably the worst examples, though, of overkill come from the fisheries of the world. These are places where often the regulations of fisheries were either non-existent or ineffective. And this is my mea culpa moment. When I was growing up in Ohio, the blue pike, which was a native fish in Lake Erie, it was the premier commercial fishery. And when we went out for fish fry on Friday night, blue pike was on the menu. I ate hundreds of them. And they're all gone. They went extinct in 1983. In Lake Michigan, several species of whitefish were similarly overfished and pushed to extinction. And you'd think after we have collapsed valuable, very valuable commercial fisheries one after another, that we would have got the message that these are very valuable resources and we should be a little more careful about how we exploit them. And you would be wrong, because if you look at commercial fisheries today, you see, unfortunately, the path of the passenger pigeon being followed. The next slide shows you, and I want you to focus on the graphs, because the graphs trace the history of the exploitation of these valuable fish, and it looks scary. It's exactly the trajectory of the passenger pigeon's decline. The background music, I think, is the anthem to overkill.
Back before the Second War, we could catch our fish inshore. Boats were small and gear was rough. We caught fish but left enough. And now there's no more fish because the trawler fleets took all there was. We could see it coming then. No more fish, no fishermen.
Some of you may know Shelley Posen. He's a Canadian folklorist. And Shelley and I actually got to know each other. He was a student at Memorial University in Newfoundland, and I was up in Newfoundland doing my own research on birds. And we were there when the cod of the Grand Banks collapsed. And I'll tell you, it was despair in Newfoundland. That was their economy. But these are fish that we are in the process of doing to exactly what we did to the passenger pigeon. And there's no end in sight. Some of you may know, last year, one Atlantic bluefin tuna sold at market for $1.2 million. One fish. And Carl Safina, probably one of the great contemporary spokespersons for marine conservation, observed, he said, you know, the fisherman that pulls the last bluefin tuna out of the ocean will think that he'd hit the jackpot because he would be a multimillionaire instantly. So we have a bad track record, but we have also managed to salvage some things that were following the passenger pigeon to extinction. We have these great comeback stories that 20th century conservation has turned things around for species that were very close to following the passenger pigeon to extinction in the late 19th century. Trumpeter swans and wood ducks and egrets, sandhill cranes, wild turkeys were all exploited heavily, and they were all, had we had the term endangered species in 1900, they would have all been declared endangered species. And of course, some of these, like the wild turkeys, now have recovered to the point where they're once again a valuable resource to us. Beaver and bison and gray whales were similarly following the passenger pigeon's path. The fur seals of the Pribilof Islands were very nearly wiped out. They had a spectacular recovery until recently. They're declining steeply again because we're overfishing the pollock on which they feed. We're destroying their food supply. So overexploitation, you would think we've sort of handled that. It's something that we have gotten past. And, of course, if you know what's happening to rhinos and elephants and other valuable species around the world, you'd know that it's apparently not something that's in our distant past. There are success stories, and it's quite remarkable how quickly some species can bounce back if we recognize the problem in time and do the right thing. A few years ago, my students and I set out on a quest to study a neotropical migratory bird throughout its annual cycle. We picked a bird that was declining, the Dick Sissel, and decided we were going to figure out where in its annual cycle it was running into problems. Dick Sissel should be familiar to you since Iowa is sort of in the center of their breeding range, but the entire world population of Dick Sissels from the North American breeding ground condenses down into one very, very small area in central Venezuela. And when they converge there, it is somewhat reminiscent of experiencing passenger pigeons flying overhead. This is a little video clip of Dick Sissels coming in to an evening roost. And if you can imagine this multiplied by a million, you might get a sense of what the passenger pigeon is. Studying the birds, the Dick Sissel was in deep trouble. It was declining faster than any other bird that was covered by the North American Breeding Bird Survey. And in 1980, a number of prominent ornithologists predicted very confidently that the Dick Sissel would be extinct by the year 2000. And indeed, if you sort of extended the line, that was probably where they were headed. Well, when we did our study, we figured out where the problem was. And it turns out the problem was overkill. And the problem was overkill where the Dick Sissels were most vulnerable, and that's when they were concentrated in these winter roosts. The farmers in this area of central Venezuela, like the wheat farmers in Iowa, were absolutely terrified when they saw these flocks of millions of Dick Sissels descending in the neighborhood. And they devised a devious way of dealing with the problem. Because the entire world population of about 10 to 12 million Dick Sissels broke up into literally a half a dozen or so big mega roosts of millions of birds each, they figured out that these birds are all packed into these areas. All we have to do is send up our crop dusters at night loaded with organophosphate pesticides, and we can take care of the problem. And indeed, they could wipe out double-digit percentages of the world's population literally in less than an hour. And the accounts of some of these nocturnal raids on Dick Sissel roosts, literally, they were knee-deep in dead Dick Sissels. We saw a couple of these. They weren't quite knee-deep, but it was really just horrible to see the devastation. Completely illegal, done under cover of darkness. The tragic risk was, of course, that you would get four or five farmers that decided to do this to the roost in their neighborhood in the same year, and you could have literally wiped out the Dick Sissels. Well, we were able to show that dick thistles weren't nearly the threat to their crops that they imagined from the vast numbers, and we got the farmers to agree to stop killing the birds as long as the conservation community agreed to stabilize the dick thistle population at its current level, which the farmers agreed they could live with. And we were successful. We were able to stabilize the dick thistle population. It did involve killing dick thistles, but at least we removed the uncertainty of having the killing done completely indiscriminately, and the dick thistle is obviously safe today. So you can turn things around literally very quickly for some of these species if we can simply prevent the overkill from happening. Unfortunately, the overall picture is not that good. You all know about the extinction crisis, the fact that, you know, we are now have over 25% of the amphibians of the world, over 20% of the mammals of the world, 12% of the birds of the world are threatened with extinction. And it is tragic that still a large percentage of these are threatened by overkill. We haven't learned the lesson, which we should have a long time ago. And there are reasons why we should care, why we shouldn't wipe these species out by overkill. Obviously, some of these are very selfish reasons. A lot of these species are exploited commercially. They are valuable to us. They're things that we are willing to pay a lot of money for. We value these species. So causing them to go extinct, obviously, is depriving us of something that we place great value on. And there's also, of course, the possibility that by wiping out one of these species, it could affect something else that we consider valuable and could be something that would be detrimental to our own selfish interests. There are also the altruistic reasons why we should care. As Aldo Leopold so eloquently pointed out, it is unethical for human beings to cause other species to go extinct, regardless of whether we value them, whether they have some direct benefit to us. And, of course, we know now, having had so much experience with species going extinct, that species don't often disappear one at a time. When one species goes extinct, it can cause problems within the ecosystem that can cause problems that were completely unexpected. There's now, for example, a growing body of fairly compelling evidence that the epidemic of Lyme disease that we are experiencing in the eastern U.S. today traces its roots back to the extinction of the passenger pigeon. When passenger pigeons were around, any of these sort of superabundances of nuts were quickly cleaned up by passenger pigeons. Now, they're there for small rodents to feed on. And whenever oaks or beech have a particularly big mast crop, these small rodents, especially deer mice, explode in numbers and provide a reservoir for Lyme disease. Couple that with our overabundant deer populations, and it's not hard to understand how the system works and how it would have been prevented by a species like the passenger pigeon that would have prevented those sort of local abundances of mast from occurring. So it's really pretty simple. You know, what we need to do, there are some forms of overkill that we should simply eliminate. The mindless persecution of things like top predators, the gross overexploitation of species, that should just not happen in the 21st century. We know biologically, we know how to make the harvest of these species if they're valuable. We know how to make those harvests sustainable. It's not a mystery of how to do it. It's a problem of having the will to actually use the scientific knowledge about how we could use these species as valuable resources to actually put it into practice.
You have been listening to Dr. Stanley Temple's presentation entitled The Extinction of the Passenger Pigeon, presented March 6, 2014, in the Great Hall in the Memorial Union on the ISU campus. This is Pat Schlarbaum, and you're listening to The Heart of Iowa, a program featuring artists and thinkers of note in Central Iowa and the issues they care about. For more information about the extinction of passenger pigeons, call 515-460-1815, or you can contact me at my email, that's patschlarbaum@gmail.com, and that's P-A-T-S-C-H-L-A-R-B-A-U-M. aum@gmail.com. And thank you. And thank you so much for all you do for country.